Welcome to Protect, suicide prevention training podcast for healthcare professionals. I'm Manan, consultant psychiatrist, founder, and head of faculty at Progress Guide.
Good day. I'm Mahi, your host. Welcome to episode 15 of Protect. We hope you have also heard and enjoyed the guest shows we have recently hosted. Ashley P. Evans with her genuine, candid demeanor, and Stan Steindl's contrasting, careful, considered approach, both have been very popular, and we would love to hear what you think, particularly if you have recommendations for future guests that you would like to listen to on the show. You can email us at admin@progress.guide, or direct message Manan on LinkedIn with your suggestions for guests.
Actually, I've got another fantastic guest lined up, Linda Hipper. She's a colleague and the Director of Addiction Services at Metro South. She's a passionate advocate for addiction services and how suicide prevention frameworks do not pay enough attention to substance use and all the brief interventions that can be done in this space. Interventions that are effective and enhance safety. So really looking forward to interviewing her.
Substance misuse and the attitudes professionals hold was something that came up in the WARE study too.
Yes, that's true. And we will be discussing that perhaps in the next episode. I've always felt that there is more that we need to do in terms of brief interventions for alcohol and other drugs. In fact, in the SAFE framework, the A stands for access to means, alcohol and other drugs. But often the access to means discussion ends up taking all the limelight and the alcohol and other drugs discussion gets overshadowed. So it will be good to have Linda early in the piece to share her wisdom. She did warn me to say that I might get an earful from her.
That's something to look forward to indeed. Well, in the last episode, we discussed anxiety, the first of the five aware factors. We finished the last show on an important note. Do you see what you want to see? Or do you dare to open yourself up to all that there is to see?
I think the context to do you see what you want to see was anxiety. And does anxiety make professionals seek out safety reassurances and ask questions like, can you keep yourself safe? They all know that risk is dynamic, and when someone says, yes, I can, really, that yes is only valid till the circumstances remain the same. And as soon as the person in distress leaves the consulting room, the circumstances have changed. But that practice of safety reassurances carries on. And it carries on because the desire to quell anxiety is a powerful psychological force.
And that is the point you were making regarding how once a safety reassurance is received, the intent to keep digging and unearthing challenges in the near future dissipates. Because although knowledge of those challenges are essential for safety planning, they would inherently give rise to anxiety again.
That is correct. Unnamed or unidentified or unaddressed anxiety in a professional may result in superficial assessments. Because the more you know, the more anxious you feel. There is another way to quell that anxiety. Quell it properly, and that involves a thorough assessment, finding out all the pitfalls on the road ahead and addressing them properly. That too will decrease a professional's anxiety, but it may be challenging in time and resource-poor environments, so it is easier to not dig too deep or plaster over things using a safety reassurance.
I get the impression that you are about to delve into rational versus rationalizing, one of the key insights from the WARE study. But before you do that, may I please remind our listeners that, as usual, the show notes, the key messages, and the messages and images are available at the podcast blog at www.progress.guide, or you can get the Protect Guidebook from Amazon to read along. The images are particularly helpful for visual learners and help with retention. Also, do not forget to rate us on Spotify or Apple Podcast. It helps us get the word out. Okay, so let's get into the meat of this episode, rational versus rationalizing.
I always get quite excited talking about this key insight from the AWARE study. I love it because people get it, it's simple, and the idea of cognitive dissonance has been around since the 1950s. At a very simple level, it can be boiled down to we see what we want to see. This is a theme which will recur through the entire AWARE framework. As we have been saying, anxiety is not a nice emotion to experience, so there is an unconscious driver to decrease anxiety, not just for the person in distress, but also for the assessor themselves. We just mentioned one of the ways, which is through seeking reassurances related to safety. So the shallow blanket statement, "I can keep myself safe," helps rationalize away why not to explore fully the dynamic aspect of risk. This is where the whole rational versus rationalizing exploration of the qualitative data started.
Can you elaborate on those two terms, rational and rationalizing?
Sure. So as explained earlier, people presenting very similarly could end up with diametrically opposite outcomes post-assessment depending on the level of residual anxiety. We covered this in detail in the last episode. So just the information cited is different. For example, when admitting someone, an assessor will often highlight the anxiety-provoking, predisposing, precipitating, and perpetuating factors. When sending someone home for community management, they will highlight the protective factors. This selective abstraction of information is the foundation of the rational versus rationalizing construct. Two very similar patients, but with very different outcomes.
So I'm assuming the examples you cited is the rationalizing part of the assessment or assessor behavior or approach to an interaction. What is the rational part?
In the interviews we conducted, we found two mental spaces in which the professional would operate, rational and rationalizing. In the rational space, an assessor will consider all the information they have collated, weigh up all the pros and cons, and then make a decision or take action. In the contrasting rationalizing space, the assessor makes a decision early on in the process and then selectively picks out facts that are keeping with the decision they have made.
So rational is information first, decision later, and rationalizing is decision first, followed by selection of information to support the decision or action.
Spot on. Based on availability, assessments involve a combination of referral information, past notes, collateral information, and face-to-face interaction. Facts in mental health are often subjective, as the most important symptoms relate to the inner experiences of an individual. The collated information gets synthesized into a formulation which informs the decision how best to respond to patient needs and outstanding risks. However, often before formulation, a hypothesis about appropriate response begins to emerge in the assessor's mind and at a certain point crystallizes as fact. From then on, all clinical activity gets unconsciously skewed to confirm the desired outcome.
Are you saying the assessment interaction actually changes because of a decision or preliminary idea about the next steps in the mind of an assessor?
Yes, that's exactly what I'm implying. If you have decided early on in the assessment process what is the best outcome, it does influence which questions you will ask. And even if there is a standardized questionnaire, that does not stop us from interpreting the answers in the way in which we do. Even documentation skews unconsciously to accommodate for this.
So it goes back to the two mental spaces in which clinicians operate, a rational space in which fact-finding is followed by a decision, and a rationalizing space where a decision is followed by supportive fact selection.
Yes, the latter is problematic from a care allocation perspective as it creates blind spots, particularly in relation to dynamic risk factors and risk factor interactions. Unfortunately, assessors are often unaware as to whether they are operating in the rational or rationalizing space. This is a theme that plays through all the aware factors.
Rationalizing is not that dissimilar to statements like, "I know I am trying to lose weight, but I've had a hard day's work, so I deserve that slice of sticky toffee pudding." I'm guessing action that I've rationalized through some convoluted logic, but there is a part of me that knows. Who am I kidding?
That's a really good example of everyday rationalizing. Whether it be chocolates or the glass of wine or the gym can wait for a day because I'm so tired. Actually, the gym is waiting a while till I binge watch season 4 of Vikings. Well, season 6 now. All of this is in line with Festinger's work into cognitive dissonance.
You used this term before too. What is cognitive dissonance?
Most of the time, we know what is the right thing to do. Let's say the right thing to do is to go right. But often the right thing to do is quite hard, and I want to do the opposite, let's say to go left. So I know I should go right, but I really want to do is go left. So this creates an internal struggle within an individual. Not a nice place to be in, you know, that tug of war inside you. So in order to eliminate that uneasy feeling, that tug of war, what we do is that we give ourselves reasons why going left is the right thing to do to begin with. Essentially, giving ourselves permission to go left when in our heart of hearts we know we should have gone right.
Essentially, you were saying it's the white lies we tell ourselves to convince us to take action that we know is unwise.
Or engage in inaction when we know we should be doing something about something.
It's a bit like someone who is absolutely broke because they cannot contain their spending impulses. They know it's an issue and they are working on it. They are living from paycheck to paycheck. They get their salary. They know that they have mouths to feed at home. So they go past a jewelry shop where a beautiful necklace is at a discounted rate. They give in to their impulse, knowing full well that they will face a lot of hardships, even to put food on the table, and they tell themselves, well, this was such a bargain. Look at how much money I've saved.
Yes, and rationalization processes can become quite complex and convoluted to deal with a person's guilt because in their heart of hearts, they know exactly what has happened. They have a spending problem and they gave into it. So they might construct an entire narrative around how this was an investment into their daughter's future. In 5 years, she will turn 16 and this will be her 16th birthday gift. How much joy will it bring to her at that point? Yes, 2 weeks of hardship, but that's a small price to pay for the smiles, because the smiles are priceless.
This sounds like telling porcupines to ourselves.
Kind of. Resolving cognitive dissonance may involve the creation of such narratives, but often these processes are unconscious. Another way of saying this is that we see what we want to see. Like, say, someone with bipolar disorder, who always relapses when they come off their lithium. They go to a mental health library and manage to find that one book, say maybe it was written in the time of the anti-psychiatry movement in the 70s, as to why they should not take medication and how lithium is poisoning them. So in a library full of hundreds of books that will tell them to take their medication and that they need to take their medication in order to stay well, they manage to find that one book that fits in with their view of what they want to do. They have already decided what they want to do, and then they keep looking till they find the information that they are looking for. Again, the rationalizing processes that we saw during assessments were not so overt as these examples we are citing. The rationalizing was quite subtle, but it was quite clear that rationalizing processes were going on in the decision-making part of the assessment.
I know I am deviating from the principal purpose of the podcast, but this to me sounds like how conspiracy theorists must operate.
Well, that is not far from the truth. If you look at Festinger's early work, there are some really interesting stories.
Do share.
It will take us a bit off track, I guess, but given how important these two mental spaces are, we can indulge ourselves a little bit, I guess. Festinger and his colleagues were already studying the effects of prophecy disconfirmation on groups of believers. When they read a story in a local newspaper headlined, "Prophecy from Planet Clarion, Call to City, Flee That Flood, It Will Swamp Us on December 21st. The prophecy came from Dorothy Martin. I think she passed away in 1992. She was a Chicago housewife who practiced automatic writing. And it outlined a catastrophe predicted for a specific date in their near future. You know automatic writing? Like, it's a bit like planchette, where you can listen to people who have passed away. So it's a bit like that. Seeing an opportunity to test their theories with a contemporary case study, the research team infiltrated the group of Martin's followers in order to collect data before, during, and after the time the prophecy would be disconfirmed.
Don't think this study will pass the ethics committee these days.
Come on, it was the 1950s. I think 1954 to be precise. Anyway, Martin claimed to be receiving messages from superior beings from a planet she referred to as Clarion. These messages included a prophecy that Lake City and large portions of the United States, Canada, Central America, and Europe would be destroyed by a flood before dawn on December 21, 1954. Through the restrained recruitment activities of Charles Loghead, he was a college doctor in Michigan, and other acquaintances, Martin was supported in her mediumship by a small group of believers. Some of the believers took significant action that indicated a high degree of commitment to the prophecy. Some left or lost their jobs, neglected or ended their studies, ended relationships and friendships with non-believers, gave away money and or disposed of possessions to prepare for their departure on a flying saucer, which they believed would rescue them and others in advance of the flood.
Gosh, that is some commitment.
True, and as anticipated by the research team, the prophecy date passed with no sign of the predicted flood, causing a dissonance between the group's commitment to the prophecy and the unfolding reality. Different members of the group reacted in different ways. Strangely, despite the fact that the prophecy did not come true, many of those with the highest level of belief, commitment, and social support became even more committed to their beliefs, began to court publicity in a way they had not before, and developed various rationalizations for the absence of the flood. Some others with less prior conviction and commitment and or less access to ongoing group support were less able to sustain or increase their previous levels of belief and involvement, and several actually left the group too.
Ah, so it went both ways.
Yes, but that was determined by the strength of the original belief. What is interesting is the sequence of events. Actually, Lake City was a pseudonym for Chicago, and in their report, they used Steel City to mention Michigan. And Charles Loghead, his pseudonym they used was Dr. Thomas Armstrong, and Dorothy Martin's pseudonym was Marion Keach in the report. So on December 17, Mrs. Keach received a phone call from a person identifying themselves as Captain Video from outer space, telling her that a saucer is to land in her backyard to pick her up at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. So Festinger considered this call to have been made by a practical joker reacting to press coverage of Keach's group. Some of the group initially questioned the call before accepting it and preparing themselves to be collected by the saucer, removing all metal objects from their persons as they had been instructed to do that. By 5:30 p.m., the group appeared to have given up and were reluctant to discuss the issue of why the saucer had not arrived. When the matter was discussed, they agreed that the event had been a practice session. Mrs. Keach received another message later that day that the saucer would pick them up at 1:30 a.m. The group waited for the saucer until 3:30 a.m., then gave up. Before December 20, the group were shunning publicity. Interviews were only given grudgingly. So one gets to see that access to Keach's house is only provided to those who can convince the group that they are true believers. Now, the group evolves a belief system provided by the automatic writing from the planet Clarion to explain the details of the cataclysm, the reason for its occurrence, and the manner in which the group would be saved from the disaster. Now, on December 20, the group expects a visitor from outer space to call upon them at midnight and to escort them to a waiting spacecraft. As instructed, the group goes to great lengths to remove all metallic items from their persons. As midnight approaches, zippers, brass straps, and other objects are discarded. The group waits. 12:05 a.m., December 21st, no visitor. Someone in the group notices that another clock in the room shows 11:55. The group agrees that it is not yet midnight. 12:10, the second clock strikes midnight. Still no visitor. The group sits in stunned silence. The cataclysm itself is no more than 7 hours away. 4 a.m., a few attempts at finding explanations have failed. Keech begins to cry. Another message by automatic writing is sent to Keech. It states, in effect, that the God of Earth has decided to spare the planet from destruction. The cataclysm has been called off. The little group, sitting all night long, had spread so much light that God had saved the world from destruction.
That is such a powerful story. Basically, there is always a reason that explains a decision or an action. It is just a matter of looking hard enough.
Yes, an articulate person can explain or justify anything if they wanted to. Like in this case, God saved them because of how dedicated and devoted they were, which then feeds into the rationalizing process.
So, when making clinical decisions, how do assessors mitigate the risk of slipping into the rationalizing space?
About time we got back to the real issue, isn't it? Anyway, well, it begins with awareness. That's why this framework is called AWARE. For conservative decisions, assessors often find themselves maximizing the risk and minimizing any protective factors. For decisions which involve positive risk-taking, or so-called therapeutic risks, risks are often minimized and protective factors are highlighted and maximized. When you become aware of the inner workings of your mind, you can discuss these things in supervision or reflective practice, or use those sessions as a cross-check with an open heart and an open mind, really trying to understand what was the process by which you arrived at the decision. That will bring about progress to practice. The other important safety check in the system is the discussion post-assessment with a senior or a colleague or like an on-call consultant. Remember to stick to the facts. Relay the facts, not your opinion, at least to begin with. Seek the guidance from the senior with an open mind. Don't just lead them on by presenting facts that will lead on to the decision that you have made or you think is appropriate. Use the cross-check in a way it is meant to be used. So awareness of which space you're operating in, rational or rationalizing, is really crucial.
Well, it seems like we've run out of time.
Well, you wanted to hear Festinger's story, but I do believe it is time well spent. Rational versus rationalizing is such a critical component in terms of awareness. Once you get your head around this, the other aware factors will become much easier to understand, and you will find that things will fall into place in your clinical practice, and you will see evidence of progress to practice.
There you go. It is time well spent. Pause and think. The decision you have made or the action you have taken, have you made it in the mental space that can be deemed rational? Facts followed by action. Or are you rationalizing a decision away? So action followed by selection of facts. Watch out for it at the dinner table, that extra portion. Watch out for it in the shopping market, the shoes you don't need. Watch out for it on the road when you race the lights. Watch out for it before you scream at your child, who clearly deserves to be shouted at for being on their phone at the dinner table. Make this reflective part an important part of who you are as a person, and the rest in terms of clinical practice will follow. Share what you find. Tweet your thoughts about the rational and the rationalizing space and tag #guideprogress. It helps get the word out about the podcast to more professionals and support progress to practice. You can email your thoughts to us at admin@progress.guide with your suggestions and comments, particularly if you have questions and want us to cover certain topics in the discussion. In the next episode, we will go through the other factors in the WARE framework and how the two mental spaces, rational and rationalizing, apply to them. You can access all the information at www.progress.guide. You can connect with Manan on LinkedIn or follow our LinkedIn page by searching on LinkedIn for progress.guide. We are also on Twitter and YouTube. Our Twitter handle is @guideprogress. As usual, please do follow the podcasts. There'll be weekly episodes every Friday and share it with your colleagues. Your ratings will help get the word out, so please don't forget to rate us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or Audible, or whichever channel you are listening on. Helping healthcare professionals become aware of their decision-making process is an essential step in creating a workforce that is self-aware. Remember, together we can make a difference. Tune in next Friday and we will explore the other factors in the WHERE framework. Thank you for joining us today and keep spreading the word.